Good evening, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Futurati podcast, where we dive into how emerging technologies will impact the world and your bank account. I'm Trent Fowler, and tonight I am bringing you a solo episode. But my co-host and I, Thomas Fry, are futurists, keynote speakers, and consultants with decades of experience in analyzing trends and communicating new developments to audiences across the world. Reach out to us at futuratipodcast.com/contact-futurati if you'd like to hire us for consulting, to speak at your event, or to advertise on our podcast. I just wrapped up a fascinating interview with one Daniel Gollier, who is the founder of a civics school called Maximum New York. And I first encountered Daniel years ago when he told me he was using Rome to map out the structure of the New York City government. And I thought, why are you doing that? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me that you would be spending your time doing that. But he made the case for it being an important endeavor. And since then, he's achieved a lot of success in teaching people civics and what he calls governmental mechanics, which is basically the nuts and bolts of how the government works, how different laws are drafted, how they make their way through different kinds of committees, how they're argued about and debated and revised, and how ultimately they come to pass into laws that impact all of us. And he makes a really good case that part of the pessimism that seems to pervade modern life is driven by the fact that we don't have a good grounding in this structure, in this system that is all around us. Government's everywhere. It's all pervasive. Yet most of us don't know how it works. And that causes us to be afraid of it or to fail to visualize the options that are actually open in front of us. And that's true if you're in public office, and also true if you're just in the private sector. So despite having sort of a very dim view of politicians and politics, I've found Daniel's work fascinating for a long time. It's because he's so interested in it, it kind of draws me in too. So I was delighted to finally get him on the podcast and to talk through all this stuff. And I hope that you will like it as well. So without further ado, here is episode 154 with Daniel Gollier. Tonight, we're joined by Daniel Gollier. After graduating with a degree in government from Harvard, Daniel founded a civic school called Maximum New York, anchored in New York City. The school's goal is to accelerate kind, smart, ambitious people into city and state politics, provide them with an atypical level of knowledge about how government works, and keep them networked together. If you enjoyed this interview, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. And don't forget to check out our website, futuratipodcast.com. Daniel, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's hear a little bit about your background, your interests, and what brought you to working on the problems you're working on today.
Well, I grew up on a farm in Indiana. I graduated from Harvard College with a degree in government in 2014, and I have wanted to live in New York City ever since I came here for the first time when I was 15 years old for a national parliamentary procedures competition. And I think that that summary origin story hits a lot of principal markers for the things that I'm working on now, one of which is I love America. I love all of America. It's a large country that has so many different ways of living that everyone can find their place. And I love where I came from, and I love where I am now. But New York City, it fits me like a glove. And as I mentioned, I could tell that when I came here when I was 15. And why I came here was a foreshadow for my larger interest in government and civics, which is parliamentary procedure, is a less well-known component of all of that. So my general interest is government and law, and I think a lot of people can relate to it because it can be looked at through the lens of complexity and systems because it is both of those things. So many people have that thing that hits that part of their brain that loves systems. And for some people, that's a certain video game. I mean, I played Age of Empires 2 and Pokemon. Those games can hit you in the systems. Yeah, they can hit you right there. But coding can do that. Many vocations can do that. There's systems everywhere. But for me, the system that called and has called for a very long time has been government and law. Ever since I was little, I enjoyed reading political histories. I love stories of America's founding. It was always especially interesting to me. I did think about going to law school, but I did not wind up going. That was more to do with the monetary cost, the opportunity cost, and realizing at the end of the day, do I need a JD to do the thing I want to do? And the answer was no. But I still love the law and government. So that's a little bit about my background. There's a lot of government stuff in my background, both interest-wise, and as I mentioned, my undergraduate degree is in government. Although, as you may have read, I do think political science degrees around the country are mostly broken, and that when people graduate with one, they not only don't really know anything, but they have tricked themselves into thinking that they know quite a lot. And so that cauterizes their curiosity for further learning. So in fact, I think political science degrees tend to not just be net neutral, but net negative for most people.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. Well, I want to get into all that, but I wanted to start with your fascination with New York, because I've only been a couple of times, but it's a legendary city, one of the great cities. And I used to travel there for work in like 2021, 2022, and I loved it. You know, I would like head out at sunrise and see the sun rising, you know, as you can see the like the walls formed by the buildings. You're walking through this like sunlit canyon and it's all golden everywhere. It's there's something electrifying about New York first thing in the morning. So I'm just curious as to like what struck you about it.
Well, as I mentioned, I came here for the first time when I was 15, and it fits a standard American tale because it is one. So my mother drove me to Indianapolis to catch a Greyhound bus to New York City. And right before I got on the bus, pulled me in for a hug, and her last words to me before I got on the bus were, "Don't forget to look up," because, and I've written a post about my New York story, but so she had never been outside of Indiana or Ohio really at this point. And we had really only both become acquainted with New York City, mostly through books. But she, despite never having been there, she did understand that people come to take things for granted that they're regularly exposed to. And in New York, the thing that she was talking about is people forget about the vertical dimension and majesty of their city. They forget that you can be stunned by the achievement of a skyscraper. And not just, I mean, people think it's the vertical dimension of it, but they often forget the city goes quite deep as well. It's not just the subways, like the floors that go below. So to think that humans can do that kind of thing is magic. And especially when you're standing right at the base of a very tall tower. But again, not only do the locals who have been here for a while, and for me, a local, you're a local as soon as you decide you are. That's my rule. But the locals forget to look up, but also tourists, you can be here for 1, 2, 3 days. And then all of a sudden your eyes are firmly parallel to the ground too. So I don't have a problem with forgetting that now. I mean, I've always loved skyscrapers, but, so my mother's advice was true. So in any case, the built environment is the answer to your question. Some people are called to the sublime and the grandeur of nature, like these enormous landscapes out west, which I think is great. But the thing that calls me is this particular man-made built environment. So that first and foremost, and to your point about the golden mornings in New York City, that is extremely true. And the thing I experienced today was, you know, is a beautiful icy blue, because a lot of the new residential high rises, many of which I think are beautiful, the glass reflects blue rather than a gold. It's a different kind of material. And it was a delightfully cold winter day here. So when the cold winter sun hits the buildings, instead of a gold, you have almost, it's not quite a jewel tone light blue. So it's a different potent beauty that's ambient from the man-made environment. No, so really that's simply the first thing.
Yeah, New York is one of the most shining monuments to human ingenuity and intelligence that's ever existed. And I think certain kindred souls feel a kindling when they encounter it, when they behold it. And it speaks to them in a really profound way. It always has me as well. So that's fascinating. And you said your interest in government goes back a long ways. I mean, did you always know you were going to be in civics how did that evolve?
Well, I didn't actually know. I mean, well, you know, some little boys want to be astronauts, some little boys want to be firemen. This little boy wanted to be president, but I didn't know what that meant. I just knew, oh, that's the person who's really in government. Like when I was very little, that's really what that meant.
The most in government.
And the most in government. And of course, as I got older, right at the end of high school, I started to realize what that office really meant, and I stopped wanting to be it personally, although I wanted to do other things. But I still retained my immense interest in government, civics, and law. And then when I got to Harvard, that's when things really started to shift under my feet in a lot of ways. So I entered the government department, and I very quickly found that most people were not in that major because they wanted to lead, they wanted to be in charge. Or another way you could phrase that is they didn't want to govern, they wanted to be in charge. And governing requires being in charge, but you can be in charge without necessarily governing well. So my interactions with a lot of the other students, with the structure of the major itself, there was a lot of friction. I wound up taking one semester off just because I was, in fact, very, very mad. I was mad at all the other students. I was mad at the university for the way that the degree program was structured and what it did not contain, which at the very base is just some sort of test to verify that students understand the basic components of government. Most of them do not. Possibly none of them do not, which is the interesting thing. And so I came back refreshed and realized I don't have to feel bad about that. I can just do what I'm here to do. And so I felt much better after I came back from my semester off. But the thing that changed was I realized I need to take probably quite a lot of years to figure out what my place in this system will be. I'm surrounded by people who are confidently going at the system to try to take roles in it, but I also see that they do not know anything. Vast amounts of fundamental knowledge they just lack, and they're not curious about it. And I didn't want to be that. So I worked about full-time all throughout college. I was the operations manager on duty at Harvard's gyms. I just kept that job after graduation. And then I went to work for a law firm. I wound up bouncing around all kinds of places. So the path goes gym, paralegal, coffee shop in Cincinnati, back to the gym, back to the same law firm, but on the PR team, after which point I finally quit in July of 2020 to start Maximum New York, and it stuck. But the general shape of the story is trying to learn much more about the world and about the specifics of governance before trying to take those reins, even in a small way. And from where I sit now, I'm very glad that was my approach.
Yeah, no kidding. Could you say a little bit more about the difference between being in charge and governing well? Because that reminds me of the distinction between, you know, being a dictator versus being a statesman, being somebody who's at the head of state and who's, you know, crafting policies that form some of the scaffolding in society. So how do you think about the difference between those two things?
Well, there's also that there's that meme or that cartoon. Probably a lot of people have seen the difference between a boss and a leader. And it's like the boss is on a sled having all the employees pull them, and the leader is also, I don't know if people have seen that, but in any case, not quite the same thing. So someone who is interested in governing, first and foremost, must understand what is a government. To govern is the adjectival form of whatever that noun is. So, well, what is that noun? What does it govern over? What is the structure of society? What is its history? What are its path dependencies? Once you just start asking basic implications that spiral out just from the word, one should properly realize what a vast responsibility governing is and what a technically complicated and complex thing it is. So you can attach many definitions to government, but the basic one that I use is an institution that has a monopoly on legal force over a given geographic area. Mm-hmm. And then you can complicate that further by saying, is it a democracy? Is it federated? Whatever. So at base, that's what a government is. Well, what is the American government, though? Because if you want to govern in America, you need to know what the American government is. Well, it's a federation. Most of our laws, most of our court cases happen at the state level. That's, I think, the first thing a lot of people get wrong. They hyperfocus on D.C. just because that's the most salient. Mm-hmm. But American federalism is very alive and well, and most people do not see the vast bulk of our governing apparatus. And that has two immediate consequences. And then I'll pull this back around to this is what someone who's in charge would do. So someone who wants to govern appreciates all this. And so if they go to Washington, D.C., unless they're working on something that really only the federal government does, they're going to be surprised and frustrated when they find that their policy is not being implemented because they designed it in their theoretical head, and now it's being given to a governor that's not their party.
Right.
And they didn't appreciate that it was structured that way. So number one, that would happen to you. But number two, if you don't appreciate all the complexity of what the government is, then you just treat people like pawns on a chessboard to be moved around. So anyway, someone who governs appreciates all of this. They appreciate all of the complexity inherent in the concept, and they treat it that way. They treat it as a technically sophisticated topic that you must approach with initially with humility because you have a lot to learn, but then you can feel mastery over time. And then the person who wants to be in charge, they're not intrinsically interested in any of that. They will maybe try to get at it if they find that they have to have it to do something. But they're not really interested in truly understanding the people or the system that they sit at the heart of. They just want to be the one who says jump and people jump. And there's a lot of different ways. There are many different reasons I think, or I have seen, why people land in being in charge. For some of them, it really is something like psychopathy or mental illness. But for others of them, it's just a genuine error of knowledge that they made long ago in college. As I mentioned, political science degrees really do shape people's thinking because they never learn these specifics. And so maybe they could have been good at governing, but they never got the full resolution of what that system looked like. And then when you get out of college, it's, well, there's no place to learn it. And by the time you get a job in the government, now for many people, it feels too late because you feel like you're in too deep to start asking basic 101 questions. And in fact, having spoken to many staffers, they're terrified that someone would catch them asking these questions. It would be used against them.
How does a bill become a law? It's like you missed the Schoolhouse Rock episode where that was covered. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, and even on that specifically, Schoolhouse Rock left out, like, I mean, of course, that's a simplification, but okay, now you actually have one of these jobs. Where do you learn it? And legislatures have internal training programs of varying quality. Most of them are not very good. And so again, yeah, you have all of these legislative aides and actually some senior staffers, you'd be pretty surprised to hear from. They just do not know how it works. Or if you ask them, what's the difference between statute and administrative law? They don't know. They have vibes because you can pick up vibes in the work, but they actually don't know the technical answer. They're afraid to find out.
Hello, this is Trent Fowler, co-host of the Futurati podcast. One of the most common pieces of marketing advice I've come across is to know your audience and give them what they want. One difficulty in podcasting is that it's actually pretty hard to do this. None of the major platforms give us any way to reach out to you, our listeners, to find out what you enjoy about the Futurati podcast and what you'd like to see done differently. So we've decided to record this commercial and ask you directly to reach out to us. Head over to futuratipodcast.com, go to the contact page, and drop us a line. Tell us about your favorite and least favorite episodes, what you'd like to see us cover in the future, and anything else you want us to know. We produce this show for you, and we want your advice so we can make it even better. Thank you.
It's really interesting. So it sounds like if you're interested in governance, that's not the same thing as power lust, right? Wanting to be in charge is more like power lust. We all know the classic dictum that absolute power corrupts absolutely, but this is a very different thing. And it actually puts me in mind of Plutarch's story about Cicero. So I happen to be reading that right now. And there's a line in there. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but he says something like, it would be strange if the keeper of a stables didn't know anything about the horses. Like, and yet there are these people who are in charge who just see all the people in their society as interchangeable units. And you're just trying to boost, you know, production or what have you. And they miss all the richness and complexity that goes into that. And therefore they don't make very good leaders. And that really struck me and kind of stuck with me as I was listening to that this morning.
Well, yeah, the power distinction, I think they both have a relationship to power. The person who wants to be in charge, they just want power. They want to have the power so that they can throw it like Zeus's thunderbolts. But the person who wants to govern, they do want power as well, but for them, it is an instrument to achieve good governance. It's not necessarily the thing that they reach for in and of itself, but they recognize it's vital to achieve these ends. And so to that point, something that often happens at parties or in social situations, people find out what I do, if they don't already know. And one of the go-to questions is, so do you have, and people usually lean in a little bit and they're like, do you have plans to run for office? And then I usually say, yeah, if it works out, I would run for city council, for mayor, governor, all of it's on the table, and I hope all of my students entertain it as well. And people don't expect a confident, forthright answer to that. And sometimes they ask, oh, so like 2 weeks ago, I had this conversation and someone jokingly followed that up with, oh, so you just want political power. And I do, in fact, want political power. You need political power to govern and lead well. I don't want it by itself in a vacuum, but of course I want political power. And most people just really don't think seriously about political power in that way. They get squirrely when they meet someone who genuinely says, yes, I want it and I need it. I think part of that, I don't know if you saw the anti-politics meme essay, but it's just they associate pursuing political power with vice of some kind.
Or as being the pursuit of coercive power over a person. It's like you want the ability to tell a person what they're going to do. And if they don't, send the police for them, right?
Yeah, power over versus power to, something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. Let's talk a little bit about how the government works. So you said that, you know, many people in political science departments don't really understand it. And I sort of have the same sense. It's like, well, you've got the three branches, you know, like people propose laws. It just kind of goes through. But I also recall a couple of years ago, I actually asked Sam Obria, I was like, has anyone written anything up about just how all of it works? Like, how do the subcommittees get formed? And if I wanted to propose a law, like, where would I even go? And like, whose desk does that end up on? And how do they review it? Like, as soon as I started asking questions, I realized I don't actually know much about this. And it became strange to me because it's pervasive. Like, the state is maybe the oldest institution that we have, or family and tribe, probably religion probably goes further back, but the state's been with us since like the Iron Age, you know, so the Age of Kings, the Lugal period. So it's a very old thing. It's pervasive. It's everywhere. It has profound impacts. And yet I don't know really anything about it or how it works. And I'm one of those people, I'll confess, I don't really care, or I didn't before I found your work. I'll confess, you kind of put me in a weird situation too, because I would say on like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm like a borderline anarcho-capitalist. I think we should burn it down and take our chances with the warlords. And then on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I'm more of an objectivist. It's like, okay, we'll have a government, but it's going to do like two things. You know, it's going to have like police and the courts, maybe the army. That's it, right? But like interacting with your work, I was like, maybe there's something interesting here. Maybe there's a fascinating problem that's worth disentangling. So that's kind of what led here. So if you want to just, what's your high level, you know, 5-minute breakdown of how the government works? Ideally, the federal government. I know you focus on New York, but whatever you.
Oh, yeah, no, I am in fact working on my version of this book. So I have a few chief organizing frames. So the first one is there are four kinds of law, and they are distinguished by who makes them. So the first is constitutional law. It's contained in constitutions, and the people make constitutions. And you can say that rhetorically, but in fact, often both the federal and the state constitutions usually require a convention or something like it. So you have constitutions, they're written down, we know where they are. You have statutory law. That is law made by legislatures. And some states, or Congress, and some states allow the people to amend their book of statute via a referendum like California. But in general, statute is made by legislatures. Third is administrative law. These are called rules or regulations. They're issued by administrative agencies. At the federal level, people know like the FEC, the Department of Transportation, the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, you've heard of these things. They issue laws that bind you just like the statute that Congress writes. So there's administrative law. And the interesting thing is, as you might already pick up on, there's a lot of words here that confuse everyone, like a rule versus a regulation. People will use the word regulation to mean literally anything the government does. Colloquially, that's how it's used. Fine. But legally, a regulation and a rule are a law that is issued by an administrative agency. And there, it's legally defined that way in the very first article of the Code of Federal Regulations, that they define it exactly that way. Rule and regulation shall mean the same thing. So constitutional, statutory, administrative, and the last one is case. It's law issued by judges when they interpret the law or apply the law. So those are the four kinds of law. They exist at every level, federal, state. And then local gets a little bit more idiosyncratic, but they exist there as well. And this is called the hierarchy of authorities. This is a simplistic model, but federal constitution is at the top, federal statute is next, and then federal admin law, federal case law. And then you go at the state level, state constitution, state statute, etc. And then, of course, it's obvious how this gets complicated, because don't the courts interpret the constitution and strike down federal statute as a result? Yes, there are those complications. I'll put those to the side for the moment. The reason why it's important to know this frame is because if you know it, you understand where and what the law is in every state, in the nation, every locality, because there's a book for all of it. So New York City, or New York State, We have a constitution. You can Google that now. If you want to know what's the law for New York State, usually you mean the statutes. What's the legislature passed? Well, you know we have one of those. It's called the Consolidated Laws of the State of New York. There's also the Consolidated Laws of the State of New York. We have a book of rules, the New York Code of Rules and Regulations, which interestingly is abbreviated NYCRR, which is stupidly frustrating because you think it's the city, but it's just the state. And then, of course, we have our state courts. Okay, well, if you want to know what's the law in, you said Denver, Colorado? Okay, well, just with that frame, you already know what you're looking for. You know you're looking for a constitution. You know you're looking for a book of statute. You know you're looking for a book of rules. So the first thing I always explain is the hierarchy of authorities. Because you now can physically locate where the law, I mean, Google, but you can locate the thing you're actually worried about. And then the thing after that, the frame after that emerges immediately from the hierarchy of authorities, which is what are the branches? What, broadly speaking, what are the components? And the American system has four. There are the three everyone knows. You have the legislative, the executive, the judiciary. But the one that developed over time is the administrative branch. So All of these agencies. Initially, most of them were illegal under U.S. law. They came to be legalized through court interpretations of the law, except for the few that were hard-coded into the Constitution. And then so I have the hierarchy of authorities, the four branches, and then the last lens that I always use is the lens of corporations versus sovereigns. So a sovereign is a thing that is legally is a thing that is self-legitimizing. It does nothing else for its authority. And we have the federal government and the several states. Those are sovereigns, and they share sovereignty in many domains. Something like New York City is not a sovereign. Its charter, which is its constitution, requires the state to exist, to empower itself. So why corporations as opposed to sovereigns? Because really, those are the only two things that exist. If you are not a sovereign, you are probably a corporation with a different word slapped on it. So everyone knows about S-corps, C-corps. Maybe they've heard of LLCs, which are technically not corporations, but same kind of thing. They know about these. Maybe they know about 501c3s, even if they don't know about many of the other 501c organizations. It's not just three. But New York City is a corporation. It's a municipal corporation. And if you look at it's the same for local governments everywhere, for the most part. If you look at its actual legal structure and you didn't know better, you would think, huh, this shares a lot of similarities with a corporation. Because it is, in fact. So once you realize it's a corporation, assuming you know what a corporation is legally, then all of a sudden how the city works snaps into focus in a way it never would have before. Oh, I understand why it has contracting authority like this instead of like the state government, because it has contracting authority that more resembles a for-profit corporation I would know. So in conclusion, my three frames are hierarchy of authorities, the four branches of government, sovereigns versus corporations. And those are the ones that I give, like in my intro classes, I introduce those three first. There are other frames to use, but I think those ones do a lot of heavy lifting for people.
Fantastic. So I wonder if we could tie that back into the original question about good governance. So what is it that a person gains in terms of their ability to govern by knowing these things? I mean, obviously you need to understand the machinery to some extent, right? But I think the common understanding of politics is that it's like a lot of wheeling and dealing, and it's more you just need to know the right people and you kind of delegate things and make backroom deals and that sort of the sort of process that's depicted popularly. What do you get by taking a course like Maximum New York that will allow you to govern effectively? Is it just understanding kind of the framework and being able to get laws passed more quickly, or is there something deeper?
Yes. So usually the way I often say government should be put on the same shelf as physics. So people expect physics is very hard and I need to learn a lot of stuff to have a good grip on it. And of course, government is not the same as physics, but I say put it on the same shelf because now your expectations are there is so much more to learn. Because most people just inherently resist the idea that there's much there. So what do you get by taking the class? Well, first of all, I think a lot of what you said is true, but I would add a ton to it. So like there is wheeling and dealing. There are back rooms. You know, it is all about relationships. Politics is social rulemaking. So it's all about people. Okay, well, if you take the class, you know where the back rooms are. You know who's in the back rooms. You know the kinds of things they talk about. You know the things that you need to say to be taken seriously in those rooms. I mean, there's some basic stuff, like just mechanically, where are the rooms, who are the players, number one. But then number two, one of the components of my final exam is you do have to draw a map of the New York City government with its dependencies at the state and federal level. That map is far more involved than the description I just gave. It goes into much more detail. So I think the thing people don't expect that is vital to do stuff in the political world is confidence. Because most smart, kind, ambitious people, they do wonderful things in the private sector. And then when they, and they'll be very confident and hard charging there. And then as soon as they start to approach government, they become meek, timid, unsure of themselves. And part of the reason why, even if they don't realize it, is they literally have no idea what it is. But once you do know, now you're, you have the confidence to act. So number one, it gives you confidence. You know where the rooms are, etc. But if you're able to read the law and understand it and how it's made, you can theorize novel approaches to change. So one of the things that I talk about in the class, it's not just what is the government. We also talk about political history of New York City. And we talk about, I have many examples of times when individuals came to understand the system and they used that knowledge to make large change that people didn't expect they'd be able to make. I mean, everyone knows the story of Robert. Well, they know of the story of Robert Moses, even if they don't know that story. But he is an example of someone who understood the law very well and used that to his advantage. It's not just about knowing what, I mean, there's a story. He sort of tricked a state assembly person into passing a law that gave him, Robert Moses, more power. He knew the assembly person wasn't going to read it. So he just, you know, said, introduce this. It's fine. And if you know how to write the laws the right way, you know, you can accrete power to yourself. But it's not just situations like that. So New York City's government is only about 33 years old. The Supreme Court struck our central governing body down in 1989, and the whole government had to be reformed. And there's a lot of stuff in this story. I think it should make most people more optimistic. But the question is, oh, how'd that happen? It's because one lawyer had wanted to get rid of this body. A lot of people wanted to get rid of it. And he decided, maybe I can file a lawsuit that challenges its constitutionality. And he did. And it worked. So it's not just the courts. You can do this in all of the avenues. You know, if you draw a map of a governmental system, all of these things have different paths of approach. So it really increases your affordances quite wildly just to understand the mechanics.
I wanted to ask a follow-up question, which I feel like you may have just covered, but you make reference to intellectual dark matter sometimes, and mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd comment on that with respect to government. There might be something.
A little bit. Well, yeah, so intellectual dark matter, the stuff that's not written down but lives in people's heads. I think most social systems are mostly dark intellectual dark matter, maybe. But yeah, so, I mean, I have I'm looking at book piles on either side of my desk right now. An example of something that's mostly intellectual dark matter, like the lobbying industry, how that works exactly. Of course, people have the idea of some guy in a suit palming some $100 bills to someone in a dark parking garage. And like, obviously that actually does happen sometimes that way, but that's not really what lobbying is. So in political science, which is a legitimate field, as much as I malign the degrees, there's a thing called, there's a paper called Lobbying as a Legislative Subsidy from the Bush era. And the basic idea is city legislative offices are overwhelmed. They do not have enough resources. And the person who was elected to that seat might have just gotten elected. So they don't know that much. Well, who is around that's been around for a while and understands this, the ecosystem of the Hill, and the ecosystem of a policy area? Well, that's lobbyists. And the lobbyists don't come to your door and try to bribe you. Often what they will do is when your interests align, they'll be like, here is a policy brief, a really well-researched one, not like it's not some incredibly very biased cartoonish one, although of course they have their agendas. It's actually very good research oftentimes. And they will, in lobbyists will invite your staffers to lunch and learns, like, come to our thing. We're going to present on our industry, and you as staffers will get to know how we think about things, which is very useful for elected officials. So how lobbying works specifically, when and how it goes wrong, but also why it's important. I do think it should exist. Why it's important is an example of part of the ecosystem most people don't appreciate. And I do think a lot of people don't talk about it quite simply because the word lobbying is comes with a lot of baggage. So if you say I'm a lobbyist, you know, and lobbyists do way more than that. They represent people. So lobbyists are also supposed to monitor Congress and see what bills are happening. And it's not just big companies. Like, these are nonprofits. These are a whole bunch of people who have lobbyists. And the lobbyists do constituent services of their own. They're constantly sending emails back to their clients saying, this bill was just introduced into this committee. Here's my analysis of whether or not I think it will pass and what it could mean for you. So, yeah, everyone knows they interact with the congressional people part of it, if they know anything at all. They definitely don't know the part about lobbyists being a genuine good information portal for, you know, the people back home.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You make them sound like a poli-sci McKinsey firm almost. It's like they're putting these, you know, 30-page reports together. And I could definitely see how if you just showed up, you're just like the newly elected congressperson from New Jersey. You don't really know that much about it. You just rode the wave of your popularity into office. And now you're like, well, what the hell do I do? You know, starting from today, it's like you turn to whoever seems to know the most about it and has like the fanciest report.
Yeah. And there is a very common phenomenon is someone, a first time member of the legislature, they're running and saying, I'm going to clean up Washington. I'm not going to say take corporate money. I'm going to, you know, dispense with the lobbyists. And okay, you get elected, you land there and you realize, oh my God, I don't understand anything. And then you see those people standing right over there who really will help you do your job better. You know, they obviously want something, and it's hard to pass up. But that's why it's hard to pass up.
That's interesting. So what do you think would be involved in educating people better about civics? Is it just scaling your class up? Or if you could redesign a poli-sci degree, maybe that's a better way to frame the question. What would go into it?
Yeah, so I have written this post exactly, which you may have seen. And I do think that is the way to scale it. So I do intend to continue growing Maximum New York as a civic school. But that's a new pipeline. We have a really large extant pipeline, which is undergraduate poli-sci programs all over the United States. So yes, the plan is to redo all of those. But of course, that means getting into the governance of universities, which is a very similar problem. And very approachable, I think, but it is a whole other governance issue. So I call my program governmental mechanics instead of political science. I do think political science is important. I just think most people shouldn't be getting degrees in it. So governmental mechanics is the study of the components of the government, what they are, and how they interrelate. So it's mostly focusing on what is rather than what ought to be. So what would be in a governmental mechanics degree? Well, first you have accelerated introductions to local government, state government, federal government. And ideally, in fact, like I think this is required, the state and local government that you learn about at your university should be the state local government your university is in, because part of the degree is you interacting with that system in various ways. Government is a practice. It's not something you can learn from books as much as many people wish it just were that. If you are not actually getting in the system, all this dark matter is invisible to you. You'll never see it. And furthermore, you will never appreciate the realities of the actors in the system should you try to help them from the outside. So you have these three, you know, the three levels. You have a class for each one of them. The local and the state need to be where the university is because you will have to go to it. Ideally, you will also have you'll have a second slate of state and local where your university isn't, because having a point of comparison actually turns out to be pretty vital. So like if I were at Harvard, I would learn either about Cambridge or Boston plus Massachusetts. And then since it's Harvard, probably they'd have a New York class as well, New York City, New York State, but different universities might pick different ones. If you're in the Midwest, maybe you have your local state. And then maybe you have Chicago or Columbus or Indianapolis or something. So you have those. Next, you have discrete seminars on more technically advanced topics. So legislative drafting, how to write a law. Actually, how do you write a law? What's the practice of it? Right now, that class only exists at some law schools, and it's just one seminar. And most, you don't have to take it. So one thing I find interesting is why don't Americans know how to write laws? Imagine if all the brain power that we have available to us, like imagine there's so many cool people writing great blogs. If they knew how to write laws, I think that could fundamentally change our political ecology, because right now, effectively, no one can propose them. So the pipeline is very small. So there's that. So you'd have a seminar on how to write a law. You would have history integrated into it. So I teach a class on the American, it's called the Founding 40, 1763 to 1803. So you learn about the American founding and what actually happened on the ground. Again, this is something most people just have no idea about. They get a cartoonish version of the founding, either for good or for bad. But for me, when you understand the founding, it's actually far more impressive than most American exceptionalists think, in my view. It almost failed multiple times. There were failed constitutional conventions that happened before the one that worked. And that's remarkable. How do you hold a nation together after a failed constitutional convention? Most people managed to have a revolution and then collapse into tyranny, but America iterated. Revolution, and then failure, 1787, and then still some failure, but it held. That's remarkable. Well, why? How? There's actual operational knowledge you can pull out that's relevant today. So various history seminars as well, legislative drafting, a seminar on corporations. I mentioned why that might come in handy. These are some of the things that would be in that degree.
What would this have to offer people who are not necessarily going to go into politics or government? So you said that some of the people that you have come through the class are lawyers, obviously, or future aspiring politicians, but tech founders, similar sorts of people who, you know, understand that there's a organizational political system as well. Like, you know, when you decide on a piece of software to use, that's like a consensus process. You talk it over, you propose different things, there's iteration, and then you settle on something. So it seems like the basic idea probably has much further reaching ramifications, and a lot of people could get something out of it. So what would be your case to those people?
Yeah, I think a lot of people do get something out of it. So there's a couple things. And in fact, so in the post where I outline my thoughts on this governmental mechanics degree, one of the things I say is probably the most common iteration version of this degree is a minor or a certificate rather than a major. Because, I don't know, say you're studying computer science or engineering, or heaven forbid, city planning, you will 100% wind up being frustrated by the government in your line of work because it will intervene on your line of work and your industry. And again, this is why people wind up taking my classes. So if you have a governmental mechanics core, maybe you took 2 to 4 classes that outline the nature of the government and how it works. Well, okay, you do that, you graduate, you get a job in industry, and now all of a sudden you start hearing about this rule that someone's going to change. I don't know if you know IRC Section 174, the debate about it.
Can't say that I do.
It's currently ongoing, seems like it's going to resolve, but it is at the federal level, and the short of it is it allows startups and others to deduct the cost of software engineer salaries as research and development. So you can imagine this improves their finances a lot. Well, the thought was maybe we get rid of that, which of course would have wildly changed the financial circumstances of many startups especially. So I got a lot of inbound about that. Like, what is it? I don't even know what this law is. Where's it come from? How's it situated? Can I do anything about it? Well, if you wouldn't have taken governmental mechanics, you would know the answers to all these questions. And maybe you do. Maybe you would want to do some of the things you are able to do that you know about. Or maybe you realize, oh, there's other actors doing it, and I can verify that there are others actors doing it. I don't need to do anything. That second one, I think, is underappreciated by a lot of people. Which is that you can feel psychological calm, ease, and optimism. Because since most people don't understand the government at all, it's a haze to them, they sort of assume the worst. So in addition to being able to act and understand when that might be, the other thing that governmental mechanics gives you is the ability to see when things are going well and why they're going well and why maybe you actually don't need to do anything. It's fine. The thing I often say in class is pessimism is free, cheap, and available to anyone. Optimism is the domain of the sophisticated, and it must be earned. So, and to, you know, there are so many people in tech specifically, they want to build new governing structures, which, by the way, I think is great. I'm all for the experimentation. Could not be in more favor of it. But for the people who are in that domain, often they're trying to do something that legally they're already allowed to do, and they're going to find out about it after they burn through a whole bunch of money, and they could have just found out about it if they would have had governmental mechanics. So it allows you to do things, but also psychologically, you're going to be far healthier if you understand it.
Are you enjoying this episode of the Futurati Podcast? If so, please like it, give the show a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and share it with your friends. By far, the best way to help us grow is to spread the word on social media, which will expose our content to more people and help us continue to bring you interviews with world-leading experts in AI, quantum computing, cryptocurrencies, and so much more. Thank you in advance.
That's very interesting. Yeah, that goes back to something we said earlier, where it's almost, there's like this vast machine operating all around you that you can kind of hear and sense, and sometimes it intervenes on your life and stops you from doing something, but it's kind of obnoxious because you don't know how it functions. And so, of course, that's going to induce anxiety in you or pessimism in you, because it just feels like at any moment some lever could turn and crush you in it and thwart all your future plans. And it does work that way sometimes. Like, that does happen to people. And that if you understood it better, it's almost like you need a chief governance officer at some of these big companies who have taken governmental mechanics and can say, no, this is already legal, like, or this isn't legal, or what have you, and can actually work to further the corporation's interests through these avenues you're discussing.
Well, and to anyone who's listening, at a large, sufficiently large company, you might have a division of your company called governmental affairs, and those are your lobbyists. Obviously, companies don't have like a lobbying division. It's often called governmental or legislative affairs. So most large companies have one of these. So, and really large companies have them at the city, state, and federal level, if you're in New York or Denver or something like that. The comparison that I sometimes draw, I hang out on airline pilot blogs and pilot Twitter just because I think it's interesting and I like planes.
Never heard of pilot Twitter. A lot of parts of Twitter.
There's also pilot Instagram, but in any case, I think it's cool. That's why I'm there. I mean, I also love SpaceX. It's part of that interest, but there's the phenomenon where, of course, passengers are sometimes terrified of turbulence. Mm-hmm. But if you understand what's mechanically happening with the plane, if you're a pilot and you really understand, you're not really afraid of turbulence at all. The thing that can feel quite dramatic when you're sitting in the plane is not really that big a deal. The plane's not in danger, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The pilots know this, the passengers don't. And it's kind of like that with government. If you have governmental mechanics, you're like the pilots. And yeah, you might have some turbulence or something, but you're like, this is well within the tolerance of the plane. Like, we're not going to crash. Even if the door flies off, we can still emergency land, in fact. But yeah, the passengers don't know any of that. Every little jiggle feels like the plane might be going down.
That's crazy. That's a great analogy, though. So you said earlier that your governmental mechanics material was largely focused on what is and not what ought to be, but I want to talk about what ought to be. So
yeah,
what do you see is the ideal governmental system, or maybe it's a small range in the acceptable, like possible configurations of government? Like, if you were designing it, how would you do it?
Yeah, well, and to me, this is a question in one of the seminars I have, because I, like you said, I do mostly focus on is, because it's really hard to craft a good ought if you don't know what is. So when I do focus on is, or when I focus on ought, first of all, it requires clarifying, okay, what kind of government? Well, if you're using America as your reference point, you know, we recognize the government's not a monolith. It's huge. So if you're talking about the government writ large, these are going to be very broad principles that then have to be applied down the chain. So a very broad principle is, do you want federalism? I like federalism. I want federalism. What does that mean in practice? Now you have to go down the is chain, you know, quite far. I mean, there's more is's and oughts to be worked out, but, you know, federalism. On the other hand, I don't know if you know the principle of subsidiarity. A decision should be made at the lowest effective level possible, but no lower.
Okay.
So subsidiarity should be at play. Federalism should be at play. I don't know how, that's a thumbs up. I don't know how I made that. But in any case, subsidiarity, federalism, and then within the domain of a sovereign where power is not shared, you should strive to eliminate meritocracy. So for example, if you're in New York City, at the city level, land use is a very common example. You should eliminate the amount of steps and approvals you need to build something. and the amount of people who get to have a say over yes, no. It should be a streamlined, very clear process. And I think that works better for everyone. If you hate the thing they're building, you know very clearly where your opportunity is to voice that, because right now people don't even know. And if you really want to build the thing, you know too. And the people who are building have predictability so they can operate in a market. So the three, so to reel it back in, to answer your question, when I think about what kind of government, federalism, subsidiarity guides where you put the different authorities, and then within the domain of a non-shared sovereign, elimination of excessive veto points. And then separately, you can think about, so these are more mechanical things. Over here, you have philosophical considerations like preservation of property and individual rights foremost, for example. So you just come up with your list like that. So this is an example of how I think about how to design a system.
So it's ultimately grounded in a conception of individual rights.
Ultimately, yeah, so
We come together and delegate certain powers in order to preserve our spheres of action in a social context. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah. And of course, like, well, how does that work in practice? In practice, you know, wildly complicated. The law is huge. And like, I think it's huge for a good reason, because reality is very strange and the law needs to account for it. So there's just going to be a lot of it. A lot of it might exist within the judiciary, though. You don't necessarily need to codify all of that.
I see. We seem to have departed rather dramatically from that model, the model that you just described, and also I think the model that was inchoate in the founding and in the documents that were produced by the founders. So I think I know the answer to this question, but what do you believe is responsible for that delta in the quality of the governance that's possible versus what we seem to have? Because it seems to be an awful mess.
In some ways, it's an awful mess, but I think a lot of it actually works pretty well. It's a big old mixed bag, and the parts that are bad are incredibly... Well, they stick out quite a lot. Well, there's also parts that are bad that don't stick out at all because they're obscure. But, I think it's also it's multivariate. There are many things that work together to cause it. But one thing that emerged certainly under FDR at the federal level is the idea that experts can plan and do this better than, you know, people and markets and more decentralized institutions like churches and local schools and et cetera. So number one, the idea that we should centralize all this power to a relatively small amount of people for the whole country because the experts know best. And, you know, putting aside the question of who picks the experts, but, you know, the experts know best. So number one, there's that idea, and it became very popular, and it remains popular. So that. Number two, I do think part of it is because people over time genuinely have lost the capacity for self-government. And this is not some it was better in the past type situation. I think you can make a genuine case for it from the perspective of social technology. So Sam Oberia talks about social technology in his book, but people do not, like, the example I use is Robert's Rules of Order. I happen to have this book. I'm a parliamentarian by trade, and this book is actually very important. It is the parliamentary standard for the New York City Council, for many parts of our government. If you know it, you know quite a lot about what goes on. It's also the parliamentary standard of many corporate boards, churches, private civic associations. It is open source. It's an open source institution manual. So if you really know how it works, it's really easy to stand up a whole institution really quickly. And Americans did used to do that. They did used to be able to stand up institutions that were effective and had mass participation, which are distinct from the modern day nonprofits. Modern day nonprofits are like small staff, don't do that much. They get funding from somewhere else. They have no mass participation. It's not really governance. So anyway, to answer your question, the political idea that the experts know best, so put all the power in their hands. But then the other thing is people did genuinely lose the skills, because as central agencies took over more and more authority, more and more responsibility, did more and more things, people stopped doing them. You don't have to have a conspiracy. They just, the muscle atrophied. And I don't think people quite realized what was happening. And now you have books like Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, The Collapse of Civic Society. Why did it happen? And of course, he talks about being isolated, being lonely, that sort of thing. But it's also this other thing. People do not know how to stand up their own institutions and reverse the situation. I mean, some do, but many people do not.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I don't know that would even occur to me. Like, I might start a book club, you know, I might do something like that, but it would not occur to me to try to do something bigger than that, where there's like hundreds of people involved. It's like, I want like the five smartest people I can find, and I don't care about any of the rest of it. Right. And I think a lot of people either would fall into that bucket, or they would participate in church, but they would not know how to generate that thought. It would not come to them internally on its own. Like, there would be a process involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think would be required to stitch some of civic society back together? Like, I'm not religious. You know, I know churches have played an important role in history and as a source of cohesion.
Yeah.
But I'd like to see alternatives. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with the churches existing, but it's not for me. So it's like, well, what would I do then? Like, how would I go about that? What's something I could bite off that wouldn't be too onerous that would start to get more of that buy-in and encourage more of that self-sovereignty?
Well, you really have to know a person to figure out. Well, okay, I'll say this. Part of it is everyone could do with reading like a few very short books about this first. So, you know, I could walk up to you or anyone else and say like, okay, what are you interested in? Like, if you like book clubs, you know, aim a little higher and try to start a library. Like, what would, if you wanted to, from first principles, of course we have the standard model of a library, but from first principles in the modern context, what does making a new library look like? What is required? And if you treat that seriously, well, that's a very fun kind of project. You learn what all is involved in libraries. You'll wind up speed running a lot of the problems that the legacy institutions have solved. You'll see that's why they solved it. But then you'll also see, well, I'm not mired in their path dependencies. I can maybe do it differently. So a lot of people have an interest that could be made into an institution. And then, of course, you have to think, well, why am I going to make a library? What do I do with that? What do I get with that? Can I support it? But make a library. You'd wind up needing a board of trustees maybe or something. I mean, the sucker is going to come to get you no matter what you do. So make a library. In my case, make a school that is now expanding quite rapidly. And I lecture now to students at extant, like previously existing institutions. So if you make your thing, it's not like it's going to stay isolated. If you make it well, the thought should be this is going to integrate into the community, and then it can have a positive influence on the other institutions. Because when you make something like this, you train people how to participate in a thing, how to operate a thing. You're creating more of these kinds of people. And then they can potentially go and do this again too. And that is the model of the old civic society. You participate because you understand parliamentary procedure. You know what it's like to, I mean, the example that do you know Elizabeth Blackwell, like famous for being one of America's first doctors. She was a woman. That's particularly why it was extraordinary. Sure. So during the Civil War breaks out, and the Union realizes like, oops, we don't really have much of a capacity to care for our soldiers. And so it fell to private society to try to figure out how to do that. And Elizabeth Blackwell convened the Women's Central Relief Association in New York City and set up this huge sprawling apparatus to organize people all over the country, collect money, and then provide medical services to the Union Army. And the government then institutionalized, like, you know, took over that institution or brought them into the fold formally. Okay, well, imagine it's the 1860s. How on earth do you reach across a whole nation like that, organize it so well, so quickly, get this mass participation, get this good institutional governance? How do you do that? There is an actual answer there. The social technology. People used to do it all the time. But now imagine people trying to do it. Imagine trying to stand up at a moment's notice a nationwide mass participation society without light speed telecommunication. These people were masters of the craft, far better, I argue, than we are today in some ways, because they did it without our tools. So anyway, you can sort of look at concrete examples of these things that happened and just really try to answer for yourself, how'd they do it? Like, okay, they had letter writing campaigns. I have a MailChimp, but they didn't have MailChimp. So what'd they do instead of an email list? And how'd they coordinate that? How is it decentralized? So anyway, once again, reeling it back in, people should think about what they're naturally interested in. Probably there's an institution that can bloom into, and you can probably give it the good old college try. And there's a lot of actual good technical information that you can find, largely in history, that will tell you how to do it.
What are some other examples if you wanted to assemble like a half dozen case studies to get into in depth. This is the Sam Obrya. He's like the third guest here. The Sam Obrya approach to it all is to deeply get into case studies. So I like that example. Are there others that just kind of stick out to you?
Yeah, there are many examples. Okay, well, the classic one is the American founding itself. So, but there within the American founding, there are many, many case studies. So the oldest continuously operating constitution, written one, is the Massachusetts State Constitution of 1780. It's the one that most other state constitutions and the federal constitution are based on. So, okay, how did that get adopted on the ground? Okay, well, so like, what kind of problem is that? You're trying to come up with a central governing set of governing principles for a large group of people. That's what kind of problem it is. And how did they solve it? Well, they actually failed very hard the first time because their colonial legislature passed the Constitution and it was voted down by the populace because the populace, led by some of the founding fathers, they basically said, are you kidding? The legislature, what was going on? I have a camera that's got jokes. So the legislature thought they could just pass this constitution and then it was voted down. And many prominent citizens said, you can't do that. You are already the government. We have to be the ones to pass the constitution. It must come from us, assembled in convention. And so there's a lot to dig into there. Number one, how'd they have the convention? Who got the right to vote, etc.? But that development, that shape of first failure and then success, that is replete when trying to stand up institutions that govern in any respect. So you can find examples to dig into all throughout the founding. The second one that I'll mention before leaving the founding is the Federal Constitutional Convention itself in Philadelphia in 1787. Why did it succeed? I think a lot of people may know George Washington presided over the convention, but what does that even mean? What was he even doing there? And you have people who are in favor of free states and you have people in favor of slavery. And do you cut those people loose or do you keep them? So what is the parliamentary art in keeping everyone in the same room, even though people literally wanted to kill each other? And in the modern day, of course, we recognize the slavers to be profoundly evil. So, I mean, they did then too, but different balance. So socially, how do you do that? Because in the modern day, when you stand up a new institution, you will have people who hate each other or at least don't like each other. So you, even for people who don't think the American founding was a good thing, which obviously I disagree with them quite tremendously. Well, if you look at the convention of 1787, you will find social technology that allows you to hold people together who are wildly different, who need to establish a mutual framework to work together. That is a very common thing people need to do and are very bad at doing in the modern day, or at least comparatively. That has atrophied quite a lot. So that's another example. The Civil War has many mutual aid societies like the one that I just mentioned. The Statue of Liberty was crowdfunded. So, it had a wealthy patron and a wealthy benefactor too, but of course the French shipped it over in pieces. Well, you got to put that sucker together and like, where do you put it together? The pedestal and everything and the grounds had to all be constructed. So it was crowdfunded throughout all of America, people sending in money over years. Okay, well, how do you crowdfund in an era before GoFundMe? Or, I mean, they had light-speed telecommunications with the telegraph, but it wasn't that common. It's not widespread. So again, how do you actually do that? So the funding and construction of the Statue of Liberty is also constructive.
So well, constructive and instructive.
Yeah, it's both. Yeah.
Constructive.
There's some people who want to build a giant monument in San Francisco Bay, and they're using the patron model. Like, we got to find a billionaire who wants to fund it. And I've talked to a few of these people, and my response is like, well, like some New York socialites did this over like 100 years ago, and they made it work without cell phones. So I don't know, maybe try their, like, see what they did.
Interesting. Okay.
It might work.
That might be a good blog post, like 12 case studies for learning how to stand up an institution or something like that. I think that'd be very interesting.
I'm one thing I'm working on the Statue of Liberty one.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah. Uh, One thing I wanted to get your opinion on that ties into some of these things is the decline in the quality of elites. And maybe you disagree with this, but it seems to me like there just aren't many Washingtons or Jeffersons around. Like an example I've used before on this podcast is, you know, Winston Churchill, after, you know, facing down the threat of fascism, then wrote a 5-volume history of the English speaking peoples. And there maybe are a dozen people in Congress that could make it through reading a 5-volume history of that thing, let alone writing one. Like, it just, something about the structure seems to have pulled out people that are not that impressive, really. Like, I don't feel like I'm being governed by people who are just better than me on some important axis. Like, they may be better at getting power, but they're not more moral. I don't think they're smarter than I am. Whereas that wouldn't have been the case in 1790. Like, the people in charge should be in charge. Like, I'm glad they're in charge. I don't want their job. Like, whereas now, I kind of get the sense I could walk, I mean, you know, I don't have the dark matter internalized, but I feel like I could walk in and do, you know, a pretty good job, or at least not screw it up any worse than they're doing. What's driven that, if that's even right?
Well, it's right in some ways, certainly. Well, okay, first I'll say, like, well, if you look at the founding, we know all the competent people because they shine like a beacon.
Mm.
Tons of incompetent people were everywhere. Right. I'm looking at my book piles. Well, no, I think the thrust of what you said is broadly correct, but to me, the instant thing to, you know, to investigate is, well, there were incompetent people in that era. There had to have been. So what was the nature of them, too? I mean, the short version of this is, like, in the 1780s, so the war ends in 1783, but we don't, the federal constitution, as we know, it doesn't go into effect until close to, 1790 approximately. So what's going on in the 1780s? The failed Articles of Confederation. Everyone's floundering around trying to figure out how to build something that works. And I call it the chaos of the 1780s. So the American people got used to assembling in convention. And so they would elect a legislature, but then they would say, I disagree with that law. And then they would have a convention and pass a different law. And then the legislators themselves would say, like, you guys, you can't do that. Like, you elected us. And that phenomenon was very widespread. The American tendency to convention, and it challenged rule of law, etc. But you see a lot of, I consider it to be very uncompelling, incompetent state legislators who are elected to these new legislatures. And they're, when they see that their rule of law is being challenged, often their response was, you guys, and this is very...
Come on, let's pass the law.
Yeah, respect the law. And so, like, these people existed alongside the excellent statesman. So I'll just say, you know, one must look at the incompetence that existed before governmentally and et cetera. But in the modern era, I do think it's true that the quality of elites has tumbled quite precipitously. I mean, and quite simply, one of the reasons we've talked about, they literally don't know anything. I have talked to several people who have run for Congress, and they have not even read the federal constitution. You know, and they wind up in my classes, et cetera. And whenever someone in my class, if they've run for something, usually we will wind up getting a coffee and I ask, like, what's your interest in government? And because I generally know what the answer is going to be, I ask, so what, you know, what did you experience of the law before you ran? What was your main interest? And then it will come out that they've not touched any of it. So I think this goes back to how the elites are trained. They're trained in a specific set of institutions with specific programs. And my whole thing is those programs don't teach you anything. And they, in fact, cauterize your curiosity so that you assume you sort of already know everything. I mean, there's other things going on too, but I think it's underappreciated. That's why I've made it one of my whole things.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's pretty easy to verify too.
Yeah. I agree, but I'm just thinking, like, who was the transportation secretary? Is that Gavin Newsom?
Of the federal government?
Yeah, the federal government.
Pete Buttigieg?
Pete Buttigieg, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Newsom's in California. So Pete Buttigieg, like, there was the whole thing about him speaking, you know, Norwegian. He knows 10 sentences in Norwegian. It's like Thomas Jefferson knew, like, 12 languages fluently. It's like, it just seems like there's a different caliber of person that doesn't make it into statesmanship anymore, or like it's much less, like those people do exist, you know, you've got really, really brilliant people, but they don't go into government, you know.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of reasons why that is. Number one, like when America was founded, we were not really, I mean, number one, corporations were still a relatively new thing legally, in the modern sense, and we were not really a nation with commerce the way we have it now, if you wanted to go into a high position of consequence, the options to do that in the commercial realm were just nothing like they are today. Government was the foremost thing that you could do, generally speaking. Whereas now, you know, commerce has bloomed. You can change the whole world by founding the right company or
joining. The opportunity cost has changed a lot, right?
Yeah. And to me, it's not just about where do you make the most money. I mean, that's part of the picture, but it's really like when people think about, I want to do big things in the world. I want to make the world better or at least different in X, Y, and Z ways. A lot of the times you can do that through a private company. And when people are evaluating their options, they think company versus government, which one do I go into? Often picking a company or a private endeavor is the right thing to do. But so number one, that pulls away more people and it pulls at people stronger than it did in the founding, just because we actually have private institutions that rival the federal government all over the place in terms of effect. So it will pull people there, but the government, people are also pushed away. So it's pulled towards the private sector in a way they weren't before, but they're also repelled from the government. And again, we come back to governmental mechanics. They don't know how it works usually, but they do know a couple things about it, which is they hear that it's slow, that you want it, that's banging your head against the wall, that it involves dealing with difficult people, that it's paid poorly. They know, you know, the terrible highlight reel.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't actually know how it works, really. So they're not even capable of envisioning their path to success. They're just going through all the negative things that will happen to them. But negative things happen to you if you're building a world-class company too. But you can see the path to success. You know what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's a very compelling answer. It's probably the best answer I've heard so far. Are there any government, or are there any experiments in governance right now that you find intriguing or that you're excited by?
Well, California forever. I think that's the one everyone's talking about. I don't know if that's come across your desk.
I don't know what it is.
So California forever, it's, so the way it's pitched in the press is a bunch of billionaires are buying a whole bunch of land, you know, outside of near San Francisco, and they're going to build their own city. And they've been buying this land up for years, and they have a vision for what the city's going to be. It's going to be, you know, like, it's a quasi YIMBY vision. There's a lot of caveats to what I'm saying. I'm just going to breeze over them, but we're going to build a new city and it's going to be nice and it's not going to fall prey to the same issues that San Francisco and other cities fell prey to. And they've issued a very robust, I think, document outlining their plan. And I'm very excited by that. The idea of making a city from the ground up. So, you know, people have tried this in fits and starts, not in ways I think are compelling. This, I think, is compelling, and it's an experiment. I'm very excited to see what happens with it. So that's one that's kind of new, but is getting press now and is happening right now, and their plan seems compelling, so I hope it works. Because if it does, I think it's easier for the next one to happen. And then, you know, we don't really live in an era where new municipalities are founded that much. Now, there's a distinction in what I just said. Of course, new municipalities off of a template found in state law, you know, the template's just stamped onto a piece of dirt and incorporated, that happens. But the idea that we're going to found a new city, of course, operated within state law, but we're going to re-envision this thing from the ground up, that's founding era stuff. That's, you know, Civil War era stuff. That's 1900 era stuff. That's when people did that. So that's very exciting because, like I said, if it works, then I think it's going to be really easy for the person to go second. You know, we're just in the era where someone needs to go first. So that's cool. An example from history is in 1898, all the five boroughs came together, consolidated into New York City. How'd that happen? Why'd that happen? Could it happen again? That's something I think about. And your question was experiments in governance that are happening right now that are exciting.
Praxis, you know, the free cities, Prospera, similar sorts of projects.
Yes. So again, I'm generally in favor of all kinds of experiments because, you know, everyone needs to try their thing. But for those who are trying it outside of America, I often find, you know, I'm painting with a broad brush here, but I often find that they do not appreciate the danger that their project will be in by planting it outside of America. and they are discounting the amount of legal innovation that they can do in America. So, I mean, Prospera is wonderful, but the provisions of the Honduran constitution that originally enabled it are now mostly stripped away. So I'm not exactly sure to the degree of legal danger that any of those projects are in, but outside of America, it's very hard to get a sovereign to respect your claim over many, many years without pulling the rug out from underneath of you. Anyway, all that to say, I think people underestimate that danger, but also they underestimate the amount of legal innovation that the American federal system enables. The example I always point them to is the development of the LLC, the Limited Liability Company. This was invented in Wyoming in 1977, and it went nationwide, all 50 states and District of Columbia in 1996. But the LLC is what modern commerce is pinned on, especially the startup world. But that was a legal innovation. You know, some people say it's bits versus atoms, and I say it's bits versus atoms versus law. You can invent new kinds of companies, and they'll change the way businesses can operate. Like the LLC is an example. That's a new thing. So there's that. But the same is true with changing the way that cities can operate. All you have to do is get a state. You just have to pass a different kind of state law allowing a different kind of incorporation. Happens. You can do it. I don't think enough people are trying that route.
Do you need a dynamic and knowledgeable speaker for an event? Thomas Fry and me, Trent Fowler, are both seasoned keynote speakers, able to converse on a wide array of topics to audiences of all sizes and skill levels. Go to the contact page at futuratipodcast.com to book Thomas or myself today, and let us apply our years of experience in public speaking to make your event a smashing success.
So if people knew more about the governmental mechanics that you teach, they'd be able to see a path forward. It's like you don't have to get to the Mediterranean. You could do it in northern Colorado. You just have to know how to draft the law and get it through, and then you can set up a new kind of city right here.
Yeah, and I mean, you can go to the Mediterranean if you want. I don't want to do that. But as you said, yes, I think there are far more options here than people know, but they literally don't know how our system works. So oftentimes, you know, again, broad brush, but they just don't know what their options are here.
All right, well, I feel like you've spent the whole interview answering this question, but I'm sort of curious as to, like, I thought about taking Maximum New York, but it's like, I'm busy. I don't live in New York. I'm probably not going to live in New York at any point, you know? So it's like, I can't attend the meeting even if I wanted to, but it's like, do I really want to invest all the time in, like, figuring out how a city that I'll never live in works? So what is it, what does it offer to someone like me who's kind of broadly interested in these questions, but doesn't have much use for the specific technicalities of it? How would you pitch to me, I guess? Sell me.
Can you condense the question to a sentence or two? Like, what does Maximum New York offer you as
a non-New Yorker? As a non-New Yorker, why should I take Maximum New York?
Well, two things. Number one, all my classes are, so far they're in person, but I have a standing offer, which is if there's a group of people around the, and I've done some of these, but if there's a group of people around the country, we'll do something over Zoom and we'll focus on the United States, and then we'll have state-based activities. But I'll put that to the side. Why should non-New Yorkers follow, watch, look at Maximum New York? Because I'm going to echo some answers I've given before. Number one, you will feel better about the state of things. And not in a shh, go to sleep, not in that way, but in a way that you're looking at reality and you're saying, oh, this is actually better than I thought. As it turns out, the government is a mixed bag and some stuff's broken, but this is working. This is working really well. And there's people working on this. How interesting. So even if you don't live in New York City, if you follow Maximum New York, you will certainly regularly be dosed with, oh, the government is forward thinking. The laws are actually good. Stuff is actually working. You will be dosed with that regularly. And right now, most people are dosed with it never. But I will say, like, the American system works pretty well, I think, despite all the problems that it has. It's still holding up pretty well. It's kind of like if you ask someone to describe what is an excellent politician and who is one, they don't even know. but I think there's some. Are they founding?
What's a good example? What's a good example?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different ones. So you could put them in tiers. So there's like founding era, I made a whole state and I inspired the state constitution. I don't actually know if we have None of those are on my radar at the moment, although there are certainly some very cool people. Then there's like the second tier. And the second tier is people who I think they do a decent, very good job at running something, even if I don't agree with them. So Kathy Hochul, she's the governor of New York. I put her in this tier. Again, that doesn't mean I agree with her on everything, but she is in favor of building a ton more housing. She kicked the door in and announced a massive housing target for the whole state, supported the New York City's mayor when he announced also an ambitious target. And you don't often get politicians who, you know, look the camera in the face and say all the things that the people on the internet are saying on the good blogs. Because I think that's what a lot of people, they just think, why don't they read all the good blogs where all the smart people are saying the things? And then why don't they think and say those things? Well, sometimes they do, in fact. So Kathy Hochul does that, I think, to a degree that would surprise a lot of people on the internet who haven't, you know, listened to her talk quite a lot. So her governor, well, what do you know about Jared Polis, for example, the governor of Colorado?
Not a ton. Actually, Thomas, my co-host, he's usually here. He had a conflict tonight. He knows Jared like quite well. I don't know if they're like friends exactly, but he's known him for years. I know he was a tech entrepreneur, was instrumental in the founding of Techstars, which on its own is pretty interesting because like most of the Congress people, you know, wouldn't know how to plug a computer in if their grandkids' lives depended on it. So
you hit some of the things. So anyway, I think Jared Polis is great. And for me, great doesn't mean I agree with them all the time. It just means you think to yourself, I'm glad they're the ones at the wheel. Okay, proceed. Like, I'm not super worried. And if they make a mistake, I bet they will try to course correct rather than double down. So there's a handful of governors that I can point to where I think like, okay, cool, you're doing something interesting that I like. And then otherwise, there's not like, for example, in New York, the thing that I'm waiting for is a legislative champion. So we have a lot of legislators at the state level. There's 150 in the lower house, 63 in the Senate, and then we have 51 in the New York City Council. There's not anyone who stands out as an excellent star who I would trust in the same way that like these governors that I mentioned. I often think when we're missing people, we have them more on the executive end than the legislative end. We're often missing the grand legislator more than the great executor or executive. That's my take on it, generally speaking.
Okay, fascinating. Well, I think I've taken enough of your time. Is there any final thoughts you want to leave the Futurati podcast audience with?
Well, I mean, if I'll tell you, you know, my take on what happens if I'm successful. And I do think instrumentally, I've already been quite successful. Although, you know, there are large terminal goals that remain to be seen. But usually what I say is, hello, people, I have created a civic school where adults in New York City come to learn about city government, and it's wildly popular. People love it. I get laughs in class and they pay good money for it. That by itself, I'm very proud of having built that. And I think if someone wants to get involved in civics or teach it, I have two rules. Number one, you need to have a good time. It's actually tactically important that you have a good time. If you find that it feels like crawling over glass, stop, you're doing it wrong. Actually, you're going to burn yourself and others out, and you're going to do a disservice to the field. So figure it out. You're doing it wrong. The second one is, if you really want to be a good evangelist for civics, take it to a comedy open mic, which is what I do. That's where I test my classroom material. If you can do that
at a comedy club, and how you decide what to keep in.
Well, it's not like I teach. It's part of the set. Like, I incorporate the ideas and the material. And the reason why, first of all, it's been wonderful. But the reason why is, okay, well, what's a comedy club? It's a whole bunch of strangers you share no context with, and you have to connect with them and, you know, get them to laugh about civics, this thing most people just want to frown about, not hear about, and think is boring. So if you can do that, you're officially good enough to teach and be an evangelist for civics, because you know how to connect and have a good time in the right way. I mean, there are people who do political comedy that's based on pessimism, and aren't we all doomed? That's not what I do at all. So find the good time, have a good time. Don't try to have a bad time. these things seem trite to some people, but to me, if you want to be an optimist about the future of America, you need to figure out how to have the right psychological posture towards government and civics, because government and civics are a part of that picture. So how do you do that? Well, it does in fact require learning about them. You know, you can reverse engineer that. So, the thing I would leave people on is politics to me is not a bad word. Politics is something that good, virtuous, outstanding, moral people do. And we want those people involved in politics, especially. I think it is virtuous to be involved in politics. And if I call you a politician, I'm complimenting you.
Well, fantastic. Thanks. That's an excellent capstone to the whole thing. It's been a real pleasure, Daniel. I really appreciate your time and for sharing your insights with us.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.